Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us. My guest today is Stefan Fatsis, a best-selling author whose latest book is an homage to the dictionary and the colorful and ingenious people who compile them and wrestle with the myriad questions that surround how to choose what words to include and how to define them. I interviewed Stefan 18 years ago about his book, A Few Seconds of Panic, in which he spent months in the training camp of the Denver Broncos learning how to be a place kicker. In this new book, he embedded himself in the office of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, where he learned how to be a lexicographer. He suggested words to add to the Merriam-Webster compendium, and he formulated definitions. And over the course of more than a decade, he found out how American English and the business of defining American English evolved and adapted to public taste and technology. I loved this book, and if you are half the word nerd that I am, you will too. It's called Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Stefan Fatsis joins me in Studio A. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you too, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on this book. This is a delightful fascinating read.
Thank you. I appreciate
that. Really, it's terrific. I'm a huge fan. So this is a long-standing project. I mean, when did you start and when did you finish?
It started the way a lot of books for journalists start, with a story. I knew about Merriam revising its unabridged dictionary from 1961, this mammoth 13-pound, 2,700-page book. Had never been revised because the internet had submersed the print book as the sort of vehicle of choice for delivering definitions. But Merriam then undertook this project to revise the unabridged online, and I wrote about it. I wrote a 10,000-word piece for Slate back in 2015. And when I was done with the piece, I knew I wanted to write a book about this project initially. The project ended up getting canceled after a few months, after several years that Merriam had been updating. But then I decided to stick around because the business and the process of language and creating a product to deliver words to people is essential to who we are, and I was fascinated by the process and the future of it.
And you've been fascinated by dictionaries, you say in the book, since you were 11 years old.
Yeah.
You were gifted a dictionary when you were a little kid, and you got the bug, and it never left.
I did. I mean, my mom gave me a Webster's New World Dictionary. It had a lot of pictures in it. It had a bright colored cover. I still have it. It's all bandaged with, you know, duct tape and whatnot. I carried it around with me for years. And you know, that love of language, of course, led me to become a writer, to become a journalist. So they go hand in hand. I don't think you can be a good reporter, writer, caretaker of words without wanting to know where they come from and how they are created and how we use them.
And you did in this book what you did in the other book we talked about years and years ago. You embedded yourself. You didn't just go and hang out and report on it. You went in and you worked for the Merriam-Webster Dictionary Company.
I did. I mean, I love doing first-person participatory journalism. You mentioned the football book where I became a kicker and I literally bulked up and had a trainer and a kicking coach, and I went to the Broncos and I spent the summer in training camp with them, trying to be credible so that I could gain access to the players and get into their hearts and minds. And it worked. My previous book, I became an expert Scrabble player and wrote a book called Word Freak about the subculture of competitive Scrabble, which I still play to this day. And for this one, I wanted to do the same thing. The initial piece I wrote for Slate was just a piece of basic journalism. I went up, I reported, I did a lot of interviews. But when I proposed doing a book to the publisher at Merriam-Webster, a guy named John Morse, I said I wanted to do it. I wanted to see how the sausage was made and make some of it myself. And John readily agreed. So I was commuting from my home in Washington up to Springfield, Massachusetts, Merriam-Webster's headquarters, and defining words. I learned how to do it. I ended up writing definitions for about 90 words. About 14, at my last count, had gotten into Merriam-Webster's online dictionary.
Yeah, just because you write them doesn't necessarily mean that they make it into the final
cut. There are editors there, too.
Yeah. Those darn editors.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
The book is called Unabridged. It's by Stefan Fatsis, my guest. The thrill of and threat to the modern dictionary. Let's start with Noah Webster,
sure,
who is the place you got to start with. You say that Mr. Webster was arrogant, argumentative, snobby, and complicated.
Yes.
So not a nice dude.
Yeah, I think he was a nice dude, but I think he was just, he had issues. I mean, he was passionate above all, and he was supremely self-confident. I mean, this was someone who was born in the mid-1700s, a little too young for the revolution, but he was sort of a hanger-on and very much a part of revolutionary circles after the war, after independence. He was a lawyer, a newspaper publisher, an editor. He wrote this wildly successful series of books for children, school books, grammars. And that led people to sort of beg him to write a dictionary. And Webster was above, you know, whatever people thought about him politically or personally, above all else, Noah Webster was a patriot. And he firmly believed that America was in its earliest stages, was in the business of creating a national identity. And he believed that language was an essential core of creating that identity. America needed its own dictionary, apart from Samuel Johnson's English Dictionary, which came out in 1755. America needed its own work because it had its own language. It had its own words that were distinct from the ones that were imported from England. So he set about in the early 1800s to create this American dictionary. And he had these firm beliefs, some of them a little odd now. He wanted to, like, replace letters in the alphabet with the Benjamin Franklin also sort of glommed onto this idea.
And he got rid of a few letters, too. I mean, he got rid of K's that, you know, the English use. I mean, the word public, for example, no longer spelled L-I-C-K.
So he was a fan of phonetic spelling. And he looked at the way that the English spelled words, and he realized we could do it better and more sensibly. A lot of the ones that he suggested were adopted, getting rid of O-U-R at the end of words, or R-E instead of E-R in words like center, and the K at the end of music or public. So he had these amazing changes. His first book came out in 1806, was panned. There was too much of this phonetic spelling. Critics didn't like it. But then he sort of set to work on what he decided would be his grand work. And it took him more than 20 years with some detours in there, but 20 years to produce what he ended up titling An American Dictionary of the English Language.
70,000 words.
Yes.
He did every definition himself?
He did. This was a solo project.
That is wild. And that was 12,000 more words, you write, than the most recent edition of Samuel Johnson.
That's
so it
right.
was not only different from Johnson, but it was bigger.
Oh, much bigger.
By a lot.
By a lot. I mean, this was an obsession. There was a long detour in there where Webster had this crazy idea about the creation of language generally, and he spent years researching this sort of cockamamie idea in the end that all languages came from one language, from the Bible. But in the end, he got back to the dictionary part, and he put sand in the walls of his study so that he wouldn't have to hear his children talking and playing. He worked from sun up to sundown, and he was obsessive and passionate and brilliant. I mean, his defining, the definitions he wrote are still viewed as top-notch. I mean, a lot of them, you'll see the traces of Webster over the centuries since this book came out in 1828.
And you write about what makes a good definition and your own experience defining words. You at one point say that it's just as hard as flipping. For me, completing even one definition was like flipping over a Volkswagen. Yeah. This is not easy.
No.
To define something.
I mean, we are journalists, Tom. We think that we have this wonderful command over language, and like every sentence we type is sacrosanct. And what I learned was like it is incredibly difficult because you go into the combination of the research that you can do thanks to digital tools, and then the process of doing the writing. The research part can be overwhelming because there are rabbit holes with language everywhere. Part of the goal for me was to sort of create these like pictures of words, these biographies, and you want to go back and see when a word was first introduced to language. How has it been used through the years? And then the writing part is sort of trying to understand and distill the essence of meaning. And that's a really tricky thing to do. It's much harder than it looks. And the reason it's much harder than it looks is because the amount of effort that goes into each definition is enormous. Because the goal for a lexicographer is to write something that feels natural, that you don't think about. We don't think about who wrote the dictionary. There's no byline on the front page of the on the front cover of the dictionary. The definitions are supposed to be transparent. We don't want to think about them. We just want to think that that is correct.
Yeah, because you're right that the best definition is so clear, concise, and comprehensible as to feel obvious. You know, of course that's what it
is. Of course that would.
And there's that famous saying that Samuel is attributed to Samuel Johnson, and AI tells me that it's not Samuel Johnson, it's Nathan Bailey, in defining mouse, right, the animal mouse, which is an animal well known, you know, and Samuel Johnson was credited with that. In fact, it was evidently Nathan Bailey, and that was one of the things that led Samuel Johnson to complete his dictionary. Because, I mean, how would you define what a mouse is? And it's tricky. Now, the other part of that is the research part, which I also see. It seems to me very tricky. How do you determine the first time a word entered the lexicon? I mean, because you're going to kind of have to prove a negative, right? It wasn't here in 1892. It was here in 1894. How do you know?
You don't. You do as much research as you can by pouring through databases. It's become much easier to do in the digital age and with greater accuracy. So what are called antedatings, finding earlier citations for usage of words, is much more common now because, you know, things are getting digitized. There's much more access to old newspapers, other sources. It's just much simpler, you know, a few keystrokes and you can find what appears to be the first usage. But then you'll discover that, oh, wait, there's one more that goes back further. Or like the reader for like a digitized newspaper may not have been exactly accurate, so it misses something. But the beauty of all this, it's like a detective operation. The hunt for first usage was so much fun. And a conventional...
But also imagining the hunt in the early 1900s,
right,
before anything like the internet existed.
Right. You were reliant on an analog way of doing this job. So the way that lexicographers did and still do to some extent their work is that they read a lot and they take note of an example of a use of a word in print, and they would make a little card called a citation slip at Merriam-Webster, and they put it in a filing cabinet. And at Merriam, those files are still on the main editorial floor. There are 16 million slips of paper there in these wonderful rows of multicolored filing cabinets.
It's kind of like the file cabinets they used to have in libraries.
They are the same idea, yeah, except these are metal because you don't want them to burn.
Right.
So, because there's a repository of like the history of American language in them. But then what lexicographers would do is they would build up the number of citations over time. And then when it was time for a new edition of the dictionary, the editors at Merriam-Webster would go to the filing cabinet, pull out the 10 or 12 or 50 cards for the word that they were defining, and from those examples, put together a definition and write and include example sentences from the real world. So it was much more hit or miss. And we have a much you know, better ability to go back and actually pinpoint how language evolves.
And indeed, the practice of lexicography, the people who put dictionaries together, is something of a dying art. At the end of the book, you talk about how there used to be hundreds and hundreds, and now they can be measured or numbered in the dozens.
Yeah. The American lexicography business, the American dictionary business, has been in decline for, you know, about 30 years. And that's partly, largely because of the internet. It's also about publishing. I mean, the number of publishers of dictionaries that you and I are familiar with from our lives, Random House, American
Heritage. I took Random House to college with me.
Sure, Webster's New World, the one that my mom gave me.
Sure.
I mean, those companies don't publish new dictionaries anymore. I mean, the American dictionary business, and we can talk some more about this, the American dictionary business has been a competitive venture since George and Charles Merriam acquired the rights to Noah Webster's dictionary after Webster's death.
Is there a case now for a book version of a dictionary? I mean, I had the Oxford Dictionary, the two-volume thing, just gigantic blue thing that came in a box with a magnifying glass.
Yeah,
it was given to me by a friend. And, you know, is there a case to be made that, you know, there's an advantage other than, I guess, you know, nostalgia or something to have to have it written down because you can get any definition you want on your phone.
No, the internet's a much better delivery system for a dictionary. Mm-hmm. And it's a better delivery system for dictionary makers, too, because you can update more regularly. It's much easier to post things. You can track usage from readers. You can pinpoint what people are looking up so that you can update those definitions before you update other ones. And that's how Merriam-Webster approached that revision of the unabridged dictionary and how it still approaches its defining these days. But it's there is an argument to be made for the book. Merriam actually published a new edition of its collegiate dictionary for the first time in more than 20 years a couple months ago. And nostalgia is one driving factor in that.
Kind of like people like to read hard copies of the newspaper instead of reading it online.
Or listen to vinyl records or wear Air Jordans. Yeah. You know, it's the same,
but it's,
same argument.
But it's fascinating to think that, you know, as it does evolve, I mean, again, the internet, everybody's trying to monetize what they do on the internet. Can Merriam-Webster make any money keeping up their list of words, which must be in the millions by now, right?
It's in the hundreds of thousands. Yeah. Can they make money off it? That's the challenge. One of the things that I learned in reporting on Abridged and being at Merriam-Webster is that the dictionary business is just another media company. It's the same vicissitudes that newspapers and magazines have faced over the last two decades. How do you get people to come to your website and stay there? How do you get them to pay for content? Merriam's website is free, but...
Yeah, dictionary.com. You can get a free version of it.
Correct.
You could also pay for it if you feel like it.
Exactly. Yeah. There are, you know, so how do you monetize this? Well, in Merriam's case, they've stuck to the advertising model. So when you go to the website, they are doing things and creating opportunities for people to stay there, games. So it's not dissimilar from the way the New York Times and other big media companies have added, you know, troves of games to get people to come there. Merriam does the same thing. They've cut business deals that are sort of tangential to the dictionary business. They have to find ways to get people to come to the website. And so far, it's working. They are surviving, partly because the competition has diminished dramatically. The only two dictionary publishers left in North America are Merriam-Webster and Dictionary.com. And Dictionary.com has a pretty small staff of full-time working lexicographers. We're down to Merriam-Webster, basically.
Yeah. I heard somebody define the New York Times app as a cooking and a game site with news as an ancillary feature.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, totally.
Because it's funding, you know, the games and stuff are funding the journalism at the New York Times. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more with Stefan Fassitz. His new book is called Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. You are welcome to join us when we come back. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz of the Maryland Film Festival and Max Weiss of Baltimore Magazine. As awards season revs up, Jed and Max will share their picks for the best movies of 2025 and theater critic Jay Wynn Russick will examine the Baltimore connection to Wicked. So what's on your list for movies, and what do you think of the movies of Wicked and the stage show of Wicked? Chances are you've seen it, because millions and millions of people have. So I hope you'll join us tomorrow for Midday. And if you just joined us today, we're talking about lexicography, defined in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary as the art or practice of compiling and editing dictionaries, encompassing the principles and processes involved in dictionary making, including researching, defining, and organizing words for reference works. My guest is the author Stefan Fassitz, who embedded himself at the Merriam-Webster office in Springfield, Massachusetts, to learn how to be a lexicographer. His love affair with dictionaries began when he was 11 years old. And in 2002, he wrote a best-selling book called Word Freak about the world of competitive Scrabble players. He has expanded his opus of terrific word nerd books with his latest offering, Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Stefan Fatsis and I will be at Bird in Hand Coffee and Bookstore in Charles Village tonight at 6 o'clock to talk about this delightful book. Stefan is with me here on Midday until the top of the hour, and you are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. If you want to drop us an email, it's midday@wypr.org. So let's go back to the history a little bit here, Stefan, and talk about how the Merriam brothers got involved, because Webster, Noah Webster's dictionary is now known as the Merriam-Webster dictionary. Tell us about the Merriam brothers.
George and Charles, they had moved to Springfield, Massachusetts in 1841, actually, to open up printing and publishing business. That was the family business. Noah Webster dies in 1843. One of the brothers is at a trade show in New York, and he writes this note to his other brother, who's back in Springfield, saying, "I've just learned that the person that acquired the rights to Webster's dictionary right after he died doesn't want them anymore. You need to meet this dude when he comes back to Springfield." And he wrote, "Because this could be worth more to us than anything we do for the rest of our lives." And he was right. And they managed to acquire the rights themselves and immediately changed the approach to the dictionary. You mentioned earlier that Noah Webster was a one-man show. The Merriam brothers recognized that in order to have this be an ongoing business, they had to take a smarter approach. That included reducing the price of the dictionary, because Noah was charging $20 for his mammoth dictionary, which at the time was about $660 in today's dollars. So they cut the price, they made the book much more commercial, and they began revising it, because they recognized that they needed to constantly update the book to make it something that people would want to buy. So they were these visionary business people who changed what lexicography was. As John Morse, the publisher of Merriam-Webster, said to me, Noah Webster invents American lexicography. The Merriam brothers invent the business of lexicography.
Yeah, the business is a big part of the story you tell here. Let's go to the phones. Tom is on the line in Mount Vernon. He's been patiently waiting. Tom, welcome to the show. Always nice to hear from you.
Good afternoon, Tom and Stefan. I'd like to know, Mr. Stefan, have you analyzed regional creep of the use of certain words? I'm going specific as a Baltimorean in the 81 years I've been here. Up until the last 30 years, porches and steps were called porches and steps in Baltimore. Now they're starting to be called stoops. Now, stoop is a Dutch word out of New York that means step or to step up. Mm-hmm. It's pronounced stoop. And I'm just wondering, regional creep, now people are starting to call our porches and steps stoops here in Baltimore. I kind of resent that because it's very un-Baltimorean. Do you have any comments, sir?
Sure. I'm not a linguist. That is my first comment. And there are people that study regionalisms and creep like the kind you're describing. But as we've seen in America over the last century, there has been a sort of flattening of dialects because of migration, because of television, because of the sort of common language that we have grown up listening to, hearing on you know, in media, and seeing from people that move from one place to another. There's a great resource, a great dictionary called the Dictionary of American Regional English, DARE, which documents the byways of words around the country. And DARE, which I talk about in Unabridged, is another sort of victim of the declining support for dictionary making in North America and America. It lost its funding. It was run out of the University of Wisconsin, an academic effort. So there's this there's still a little bit of updating going on, but DARE's this incredible resource that is online and that you can support, where you could look up porch or step or stoop and see what the evolution of the word is. Unfortunately, what you're not going to get is sort of the update that you're talking about. How have a lot of these words shifted in usage in their native places.
Yeah, and there are definitely regional differences. When I was in high school, we moved from Boston to Atlanta, much to my chagrin. I was not happy that my father got transferred and we had to move yet again. We moved a whole bunch of times when I was a kid. But in Boston, a Coke could be called a pop.
Right.
But they don't call them that in Atlanta. A milkshake in Boston was a frap. And in Georgia, it's a milkshake. So, I mean, there are different names for the same
sure.
thing, you know, all over the country.
It's the sub-wedge hoagie
yeah.
conversation, yes.
Exactly. Well, thanks for that great question, Tom. Let's go back to the phones to Peter from Baltimore, who's on the line. Welcome to the show with Stefan Fatsis.
Yes, good afternoon. Tom, regarding your comment that the print edition might have a serendipitous value, I would expand on that and acknowledge that the online dictionaries, yes, are very direct and efficient, taking you to a single word that you may be looking for. But the print edition offers the opportunity yes. on the way to find that word. You flip through the pages, you're effectively browsing and might come across another word that sets off a little spark, or the illustrations that are
sure.
found in the print editions really open up more than just a sort of melancholic, in the old days kind of feeling.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, yeah. Peter. That's an excellent point. And I noticed when I was in college, when I finished a master's degree, and I decided that I was uneducated. So I got a master's degree from Boston University. I was in Boston. I went to the Boston School for Adult Education and took a grammar course, the best course I have ever taken,
really?
Better than anything I had taken in my, and I went on to get a doctorate, and it's still the single best course I've ever taken. Fantastic. Because I didn't know how to diagram a sentence and stuff. I had, you know, been given all these degrees, and I felt illiterate. So, you know, sometimes you have to do that. But at the time, I made it a point when I read a book, if I encountered a word I didn't know, I looked it up in the dictionary and I wrote it down. And I still have that notebook. And now because I look it up on my phone, I don't write them down. So I don't remember them as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, and this, the two things here, it's a great point that the caller makes. One of the joys of the dictionary is this serendipitous random walk
yeah.
through these pages. You open the dictionary looking for one thing and your eye goes to something else. You see the word at the top of the page and that makes you want to look at that word, which leads to something else. So I mentioned earlier that Merriam published a new edition of its collegiate dictionary for the first time since 2003. Part of the thinking, at least to me, this was not because people are like demanding a new edition of a print book, of a 5-pound dictionary to buy. It's more the nostalgia, as we mentioned, but it's also the idea that there is something permanent about the printed page. The marketing that Merriam used to and is using to sell this book is that it's the anti-artificial intelligence. It's actual intelligence. You can see it right here. The argument against the book is that it's outdated as soon as it rolls off the presses.
Yeah.
There are new words being created. We need a better system to update them as opposed to just doing a new printing every year. So yeah, that's where the internet is more efficient. People want to be able to look up a word on the phone that's in their pocket and not have to pull down a big book off the shelf.
You talk about a Silicon Valley startup called Wordnik, and the motto there was all the words. Because obviously Merriam-Webster, if they're going to publish a book, they have to make decisions. Okay, some words can't be included.
Sure.
You know, and new words can't be added because it's a book. So all the words, you're right, meant that a dictionary would not discriminate or omit or reject anything. And of course, the universe doesn't have enough lexicographers to define
Correct.
Every word
That's
in the
world.
That's
the main thing.
Yeah.
It's that there's just too many words, too few people, too little time. The idea behind Wordnik, which is still up, and you can go to the website and sort of explore, browse in a way that's very different from going to Merriam's website. The idea there is that there is a way, if we can harness the power of search of databases, we can create this collection of words without discriminating against anything because it hasn't reached a particular level of usage that justifies its inclusion in the dictionary or justifies devoting the person hours of research and writing that are required to create the definition to upload it into the database. So you find a way that you can just collect by using the power of computing words that are out there that haven't been put in this repository and let technology do it. It's more expensive than its founder, a former lexicographer named Aaron McKean, thought it would be, more time consuming, more difficult, but there's been progress there. I mean, one of Aaron's innovations has been that you can craft a good entry for a word just by collecting examples of its usage and let the reader sort of suss out what the meaning is without having someone doing the work of the lexicographer to type up a definition and add it.
And AI obviously can you know, collect all of those usages.
In theory. AI, and part of the problem with, or part of the challenge that dictionary makers like Merriam-Webster and Oxford and Cambridge and other English dictionaries, Collins, are facing is that when you go to Google now, you type in a word or a word and the word definition next to it, and the first thing you're going to get in most cases is an AI overview. That's going to prevent you from scrolling down to the link for Merriam-Webster or Oxford or dictionary.com or anybody else. And if people aren't clicking on those links, they're not going to the websites, they're denying them viewers. Fewer viewers means lower advertising rates that they can charge.
Yeah.
And that's where the revenue comes from. So there's the AI is an incredibly powerful tool. And I have a chapter in Unabridged about artificial intelligence and how it fits into this business. But it's also a big reason for the threat that a company like Merriam's going to face.
The book is Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. The author is my guest, Stefan Fatsis, and we will talk more about Unabridged after a quick break. You can join us when we come back. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Stay with us.
This is member-supported 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Stefan Fatsis. His journalism has appeared on NPR and in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Slate, Sports Illustrated, and many other publications. He is the author of 4 books, the latest of which is called Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Stefan Fatsis will be at Bird in Hand Book and Coffee Shop tonight at 6 o'clock. I'll be there with him. You are welcome to join us then or now here on Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. So, Stefan, we talk about, you know, the role of AI and you know, computation in general. There's actually a subfield of lexicography that you write about called computational lexicography. There's a guy named Orrin Hargraves. He's a practitioner of Buddhism and a computational lexicographer. What is that?
It's someone that uses the tools of computing to help understand language, to determine how words are used, how they're used in relationship with one another, and to then help assess meaning and not so much draft the meanings, but create the tools to help us see where and how words are used. And it's incredibly efficient. You want to be able to do this because these tools are powerful. And as I was talking about earlier, you can very effectively and quickly go back in time and see how words evolved and how their use has changed over decades. And then you can also be very precise about understanding how words work in relationship with one another.
It's interesting because he has an example that you cite in the book on which Hargrave says that evidence often contradicts what you think. And he says a good example is the verb cause. He says it makes something bad happen. This is on page 76, if you want to glance at it in your copy. You never say cause happiness or cause joy. You say cause disaster. I'm not sure I buy that argument.
Yeah, there's a footnote that
I could be caused to smile, you know.
I actually did include an end note about that because I did my own little computational lexicography that kind of disproves that a little bit. I think generally Oren is exactly right. Like when we typically use that phrase, we use the word to cause, we do think of disaster. Or something bad happening. But there are plenty of counterexamples to that, yes.
Yeah, because I think of causality versus, you know, coincidence or whatever people pair with that.
But... Yeah, so here's my...
Where's the end note?
Here's my end note. Okay, I went
if
to...
If ever there were a book we needed to read the end notes, it's this one.
Thank you. I love my end notes. I worked very hard on the end notes for this book. Please read them. So I went to Google's Ngram viewer, which you can compare how words, the frequency that words are used over time. The Google Ngram viewer is really cool. And I write, the frequency of cause disaster has indeed outpaced cause joy and cause happiness since the 1800s, but the gap has narrowed in the last century. And in a standard Google search that I did in January of 2025, both cause joy and cause happiness delivered more hits than cause disaster.
There you go. Okay. All right. That's the final word there on that one. You were involved in several years of voting for the word of the year. The word of the year this year, by the way, for 2025, I don't know if you've heard this, it's 6-7.
It was one of them. That was dictionary.com. Uh-huh. Word of the year. There are many words of the year. And in fact, the granddaddy of words of the year is voted on by the American Dialect Society. It's a group of
And they haven't voted yet.
They vote this weekend. Uh-huh. So okay. Mark your calendars. Keep an eye out to see what they pick for the word of the year. But yes.
But dictionary.com, 6-7, it's not even a word. It's two numbers.
Well,
Does that count?
It is a lexical unit, is how we like to refer to them. Words are not just individual words. They can be collections of words. They can be hyphenated words. They can be abbreviations. They can be hashtags. They can be even emoji now are considered candidates for word of the year. So 6-7 is, I think, really interesting. Adults, 6-7 is this nonsense phrase that mostly tweens have been using for the last year or so, spoken at whenever, used in no particular context, often accompanied by a little hand gesture.
Very difficult to define because it seems like it could mean almost anything.
Because it's kind of a nonsense phrase. But it, to me, for all of the umbrage at 6-7, oh no, the kids are saying something, it's no different than any other catchphrase or piece of slang that young people have created forever. That's how so much of modern and familiar usage bubbles up into language. It's through creative use, often by young people. There's a professor at the now retired linguistics professor at the University of North Carolina named Connie Ebley, who every semester would ask her students to write down on an index card the latest slang that they were using, that students were using. Hundreds and hundreds of those words are now citations in the Oxford English Dictionary and in a very prominent online dictionary of slang called Green's Dictionary of Slang. That's how language is
created. Well,
she had
a great pool of resource right there.
She sure did.
The kids are sitting there in her classroom.
Totally.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So I'm not anti 6-7 the way most adults are.
Because another one of the subgenres of lexicography is what you call sociolinguistics, talking about how words fit into social situations and in society. You even say that The Simpsons was the source of at least two words. It took a while for them to make their way into the dictionary, mm-hmm. but the writers for The Simpsons invented two words. Is embiggen one mm-hmm. of them, right? Embiggen and cromulent.
Cromulent, yeah.
And in 2023,
yeah.
It finally made it into the Merriam-Webster dictionary. So these guys are sitting around, guys and women sitting around a writer's room for a TV show, and they come up with these words, and presto chango in a couple of years, they're in the dictionary.
They're part of the language, yeah. And again, that reflects the way that words are created, disseminated, and accepted into culture. I actually went and tracked down one of the writers on The Simpsons and interviewed him, a guy named Dan Greaney. He's the guy that came up with embiggen.
What does it mean?
It means to make bigger. And it turned out that Greaney thought he was inventing a new word. I found, and other people found, a reference in like an old version of Twitter from the 19th century, like a compendium of little notes and tidbits in an English magazine that where the word embiggen popped up. He was a little disappointed to learn that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I told him, like, no. Like, that is not an original source. You're good. You came up with this.
And he was devastating.
Devastating to have to find out when you thought you were the inventor. But yeah,
I had a friend, Sandra Smith, who when you're on your screen and you have the X that gets rid of the document, and you have the minus sign, which minimizes it. She would call that smallerizing.
Ooh.
And I thought that was a really good word.
Same thing.
I'm going to smallerize this, yeah. And it'll only take up half the screen or whatever.
I like it.
So I like that. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Frederick. Dave is on the line. Welcome to the show with Stefan Fatsis.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I wanted to ask Stefan what kind of looks he had into the Oxford English Dictionary and how it relates to the American language. Back when I was doing graduate work at the University of Oklahoma in the 90s, the Oxford English Dictionary was essential to find the origin of words at the very beginning of research.
I visited Oxford and spent a couple of days at the OED as part of my reporting for this new book, Unabridged. And the approaches are different. Oxford is what's known as a historical dictionary. So when you go to the OED's website and you look at an entry, you will see a list of example sentences or partial sentences in some cases for the use of the word from the beginning. So you will see what is believed to be the oldest example sentence and then a series of more recent ones as far up to date as the editors have been able to do. So there's a different purpose. The reason the OED took so long, like 70 years, to go from the start of its the project to the completion from A to Z in the early 1920s, was that this process was far more comprehensive than what Merriam was attempting to do.
And they were concerned with etymology. Then they were concerned with the source of the word, where it comes from, where it's derived from, kind of stuff.
Merriam is too. I mean, all dictionary makers are. But what separated Oxford was the intent to create a sort of a historical timeline for every word. So the goal is to go back as far as you can and find the very first usage. And the way that that the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary, James Murray particularly, the first editor, did that was by crowdsourcing. They put out calls in newspapers and other publications for citizens to write down sentences from publications, books, magazines, whatever, and send them in. No different than the way that Merriam-Webster editors over the decades collected example sentences by doing that work, reading and writing things down. So the OED amassed this vast collection, and that's how the Oxford English Dictionary was built. So the approach is different, and then the business approach is different to today. Merriam still remains this competitive business that has to make money and generate revenue in order to survive. The OED is funded by the university. It is considered a sort of a public
it's
private.
Part of their brand.
Part of their brand. It's never made money, and the OED kind of boasts that that's not what we're about. We are about creating this and sustaining this British tradition, this heritage of this language.
And there are trade-offs. You write about the Encyclopedia Britannica, which ends up buying one of the dictionaries.
Merriam-Webster.
Merriam-Webster, okay.
Yeah.
And but what happened to that when Wikipedia came on? But Wikipedia has a whole bunch of people contributing, and sometimes they get it wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, and in the, that was...
Because they're not scholars necessarily.
Right.
They're
so 20, 20 plus years ago, that was the argument that Encyclopedia Britannica was wielding against Wikipedia. That one editor compared it to going to a public restroom. You never knew who was there before you were. over time, Wikipedia has become much more reliable. And the idea of buying an encyclopedia just faded away.
Yeah.
And Encyclopedia Britannica got out of the business of printing big books, publishing those big books. The website
still
has a
online.
Big staff.
Yeah,
I mean, there's still a big, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica still has a big staff and it still updates its website. But as a business, Britannica has pivoted to other industries, AI, educational software. It is not an encyclopedia business anymore.
Yeah, you gotta change with the times. Let's go back to the phones. John is on the line in Highlandtown. Welcome to the show with Stefan Fatsis.
Thank you for having me.
So what's on your mind?
So I'm an ESOL instructor, and I've always encouraged my students to use an actual dictionary. And the reason I give them is when you look up a word online, well, you just get that word in that word's definition. Whereas when you open a page of a dictionary to find that same word, you have columns of words that might strike your curiosity. And we use a dictionary specifically for English learners in the classroom. And a lot of times they'll have images for some of the words, and that, you know, you might see this image for a word you're not looking up, and that might make you curious about that word and read that word. And in the same way, I like reading a paper newspaper as opposed to a newspaper online.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And you bring up an excellent point, because for Merriam and other dictionary companies, the English learners market is enormous. We tend to think of the dictionary as just something that is this utilitarian thing for average readers or curious people. But the English learners market is very, very important to the future of that company and other companies. And the print books are still a core of learners' dictionaries.
Yeah.
It's not just the website. And there's a good reason for that. The ones that the caller just cited, and encouraging the use of books. And when I run a Scrabble club at a middle school in Washington, and I've done this for years, and I keep the official Scrabble Players Dictionary on the table, and when the kids want to know what something means, I tell them, look it up.
In the book. Yeah.
Look it up in the book.
Let's finish with an email from Charlotte, who says that the suffix ality is tacked on to too many words like functionality, physicality. What do you think about that?
I think it's great that we create suffixes and they get popularized and words shift. We have shifts from nouns into verbs. We have creative uses of words that we are comfortable with. That's how language evolves. It's not static. Words come from people's imaginations and their curiosity and their inventiveness. So when people complain about the use of words, oh no, the use of literally now means figuratively, what a disaster for English. My retort is, well, that's how people use the language, and that's what dictionaries are there to reflect. You might complain about it, but the reality is language is what people make it.
Yep, indeed. Stefan Fatsis, his new book is a gem. It's called Unabridged, The Thrill of and Threat to the Modern Dictionary. Stefan and I will chat more about the book tonight at Bird in Hand Coffee and Books in Charles Village here in Baltimore. That event begins at 6 o'clock, and I'm looking forward to it. I'll see you later.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Tom, and I hope people will come out and join us tonight.
Indeed we do. And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz and Max Weiss, plus J. Wynn Russick joins me to talk about a local connection to the phenomenon that is the stage show and films Wicked. Coming up, investigative reporter Eric Lichtbau reports on the national surge in violent bigotry and white supremacy encouraged by rhetoric from President Trump. We'll talk about it on Fresh Air at the top of the hour after the news. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
This is your local NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.